Welcome to the Upward Running Podcast, where faith fuels your fitness journey.
Welcome back to the Upward Running Podcast. This is your one stop each week to be motivated and inspired to get off the couch and onto the running trail, where you can in turn inspire others to do the same. Let's learn, laugh, and leap into running together, giving God the glory for what we are able to do in His name. Amen. Well, I'm your running host, Dean Thompson, once again in the Upward Sports Studio. It is a special week this week as we celebrate the birth of our Savior. And now, several years ago, I wrote a Christmas story. And so it has become tradition to share this on the podcast every Christmas. And we're going to do that again today, along with some normal content. Normally, we do it by itself. This time, we're going to do a little bit more. So, and I'll have my third partner in the last 3 weeks along for the ride. This is episode number 300. So this is a special episode too, for more than one reason. He is no stranger to this podcast. He's also the son of Mitchell and Holly Hollis. Lane, how's it going?
I'm pretty good, Dean.
Good. How are you? Is it your third time, fourth time, fifth time?
I think it's my third or fourth time. I just know that it's one more than Angie. So that's what I have to keep. Every time Angie comes on, I have to then come on to become the most reoccurring, because she always beats me.
Well, that makes sense. Okay. All right. So you've graduated college now.
Yeah.
You've gotten married.
Yep.
So what's that like?
Oh, it's pretty good. I do have to pay bills, which is
Man, that stinks, don't it?
Yeah, it's not cool. Buying groceries is not cool, but it is. It's fun. It's nice.
Yeah. So what surprised you the most?
I mean, my mom will say, duh, but planning dinners.
Yeah.
You do have to think about it. I would say meals. Everything around food just takes more. It takes more work to be healthy in the food area than you would have thought it did. Because, I mean, if you're not going to spend $200 on lunches at work, you got to really put in some time on Sunday to prep it.
To get everything together. Yeah.
Yeah.
So now, do you feel like you've taken your mother for granted for years?
Maybe not for granted, but I just didn't maybe appreciate the work that goes into it.
Good stuff. Well, for those of you who don't know, some of you have heard Lane before. You kind of know Lane's story, but Lane was the second highest ranked triathlete in the country in his age group at one time several years ago, and has since run cross country and a little bit of track at UTC, University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, which is a Division I school. And he's a pretty stand-up guy. He also has a good relationship, a real relationship with our Lord and Savior. So I see you're still running some.
I am.
So yeah. How much are you running now?
Well, when I got married, I didn't run consistently for quite a while. But I guess probably July, I started becoming more consistent again. Because me and my wife, Christian, we were kind of halfway training for Turkey Trot. And so, yeah, we trained for that, went through a couple strength blocks, which helped because after I got married, I didn't run for a while, and I really experienced what it was like to be, because that was the longest, from when I got married to July, or I guess February, really, because I wasn't training like 2 months before I got married. That spurt of time was the longest that I did not train since I was five.
Wow.
And so...
You got to feel what it's like to be in not great shape.
Oh, yeah. But I will say, though, when you are in not great shape, you get to feel like what it's like to get in shape quick. Like the gains of training, I guess, it's really cool because once you've done it and then you kind of stop and then you do it again, it's cool to see.
It comes back fairly quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's not like it's not like you're trying to run a 5 minute mile and then a 4:58. It's like when you're coming back, it's like 1 week you're running 6:30 and then 2 weeks later you're running 6:10, and it's like, wow, this is...
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That was cool.
Big gains really quick. Yep. I remember those days.
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way when you're 60, by the way.
Well.
Just keep that in mind as you age. Well, our post of the week this week comes from Michaela Watson. By the way, if you hear my voice and it sounds a little different today, it's because I've got some kind of a little cold. It's fine. I feel fine. I just, my voice is a little bit funky today, so hang in there with us. Today's run was cold, slow, and absolutely beautiful. Snowy miles just hit different. Quiet, peaceful, and a reminder of how far I've come. I just completed run 27 of my Couch to Marathon journey. So far, I've logged 44 miles and over 14 hours of running time. 14 hours of showing up, even when it's hard, even when it's cold, even when I doubted myself. And now I'm 24 days and 10 runs away from my first 5K, the one I'm fully running on January 1st. The countdown is officially on. If you would have told me a few months ago that I'd be out here running in the snow, I would have laughed. But here I am, choosing consistency, choosing growth, choosing me. Grateful for the journey, the progress, and the God-given strength that carries me through every mile. Here's to snowy strides and big dreams. I love this. I love the way she's talking about, she's looking back and she's looking forward at the same time. And I think we need to do that. We all should do that. We all should keep in mind that we should be looking behind us less than we look in front of us, but we should, mm-hmm. we should be doing both. And it's amazing what we can do when we put our mind to something and we get consistent about it. And that's what she's talking about here is just, she's getting out there in the snow because she wants to be consistent and do it no matter what. Right. Yeah. We've had some fun times in the snow, haven't we?
Oh yeah.
I still, a picture comes up on my phone every once in a while of us standing at the Grove Level Pavilion there with the snow in the background yeah. and us all lined up. I think we had a group yeah. of about, I don't know, there's about 12 of us yeah. that went to run that day. We ran about, I don't know, six miles or so.
Yeah.
And it was coming down pretty good.
It was. I do remember that. Yeah. That was fun.
It was fun. But she kind of talks about how simple it is. not directly, but it really is simple. It's just, it's not so easy, but it's one foot in front of the other. It's one workout after the other. It's what she calls just showing up. And before long, you've accomplished something when all you do is just show up. So our run of the week comes from Greg Chance. He says this, the California International Marathon. You know how Strava only counts moving time? Yeah, I didn't get an official time, but I did finish. Getting up so early, 2 a.m., I wanted to make sure I would have food in me, so I made extra food for breakfast in order to have some this morning, and of course, I did. The bus ride from Sacramento to Folsom was horrendous. Word to the wise, never sit on the wheel well of a school bus. I'm sure that didn't help. For almost a week prior, I stopped taking my diabetes meds with the idea that they caused my bathroom issues last year, causing my DNF. Needless to say, those weren't the culprits because the same thing happened this year. I measured out everything out early in the race, too. I started in the 520 corral and was strict with my running uphill versus down. I'm still too slow for my liking, but at least it gave me a chance for success. I had to use the restroom, the same exact spot, but was in and out pretty quick. But the next one didn't turn out so well. And wouldn't you know it, I realized it was out of toilet paper after I started and had to use seat protectors. Been there, done that. In the end, Strava says I finished in 5:59, which, while being slow, would have been under the six-hour cutoff. That's moving time, though, and not reality. As I came in the corral, there was no timer or timing map, so I was looking around for it. A guy came up to me, put his hand on my shoulder, and said, "You don't have an official time. You realize you came in after the cutoff? That's why. But here's your medal for finishing." So that happened. For giggles, and he lists out all of his splits. Greg's been posting a lot of his runs all along this journey of getting to this California International Marathon. It's been fun to watch his progress, and this was the payoff. And he may not have had the experience maybe that he wanted to, but you know he did it anyway. And there's two things I think that were really important to note in this particular post. One, he talks about stopping taking his diabetes medication. First of all, if you are stopping taking medication, be careful of that. Make sure your doctor's on board. And Greg may have called his doctor and asked his doctor, or this may be a medication that he takes as needed. I don't know the story behind it. I just want to say be careful with that. And then the second thing I want to say is don't assume you know what went wrong. I don't know how many times I've heard somebody say,
hydration. Usually it's hydration. Somebody always says, you know, the reason why I crashed today is because of my hydration. And so often I know as a coach, I know that was not the reason. It just wasn't. You don't crash in a 5K because your hydration was bad. You just don't.
Yeah.
And but so many people think that they do. And it be real careful. In this case, Greg is assuming that that's what caused it. Now, that's a little too strong. He thinks that's what caused it.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to change something. And that's a good thing to do. There's nothing wrong with that. Sometimes, though, you just have a bad day. And sometimes there's a coincidence and the same thing happens again. I'm not saying you shouldn't try to diagnose what your problem is. You should, for sure. But don't assume you know the answer, right?
Yeah.
Make sure you're ready to dodge and weave. Anyway, it always breaks my heart to hear that a finish line is broken down before somebody finishes. I remember being at the Mayberry Half Marathon, and we had somebody out there running, and they tore down the finish. I mean, everybody, all the cars were gone. Everybody was gone, and we're waiting for one person to finish. And I want to say this because this person obviously waited for Greg to finish and had his medal with him and made sure he got his medal. That's awesome that that guy was willing to stay. And in this case, in the Mayberry Half Marathon, there was a lady who said, I'm not going anywhere until that last person crosses the finish line. And she hung around for probably 30 minutes after the finish line was all torn down and everybody else was gone. And she said, I'm here. I'm going to be here. And she did. And so shout out to the Mayberry Half Marathon for being so kind in that situation.
Is that like Andy Griffith, Mayberry?
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah, it's pretty cool. It's the medal for that particular one had the bullet from, Barney.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Of course, in our run, when we had Run for God races back in the past, we never tore the finish line down. Matter of fact, we made everybody gather around the finish line for the last finisher.
Yeah, well, I remember the tri-team, we used to go out and run the last finisher in.
That's right.
Which is always fun. And usually the youngest person on the tri-team wouldn't understand what was going on.
Yeah.
And so they would, you know, out-sprint them, which is funny, but.
It was cute. It was cute. Our trivia question from last week. And I said, fair warning, there's no perfect answer for this week's question. And the question was, what is the coldest temperature that it is safe to run in? What do you think? What do you think is the safest temperature?
So when I saw this question, it is just not the right question for me personally. Because as a young one, as a young child growing up with you as my coach and my father as my coach, this would be a trick question.
Good point.
I mean, now we live in Georgia, so we never really got below, like, maybe if it was really cold, it was like 15, 20 degrees.
Yeah.
But realistically, I would think negatives are, like, just answering this question, I'd say negatives are probably getting, you know, you gotta make sure you're prepared.
yeah, for sure, for sure. It's a different ball game then, right?
Yeah.
Well, the best single and direct answer that I found was that at minus 15 degrees Fahrenheit, frostbite can set in within 30 minutes. And so they say that that is probably the point at which you probably should not be running outside. Now, I don't know what that means from a – because sometimes it's 5, but the wind chill makes it 20 below.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what that means as far as that goes, whether that means you shouldn't do it based on a wind chill of minus 15, because that is something that can happen.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So I don't know, but it's not quite that simple. I've run, the coldest I've ever run in, it was minus 6.
Oh, wow.
And they said the wind chill was 60 below. I find that hard to believe. I look at wind and temperature, and that seems like a stretch. But it was probably 30 below at least, because the wind was whipping around pretty hard. And we were out kind of on a plain over a lake. And so you know how water comes across a lake really hard. Anyway, that it was cold. It was stinking cold. And when I got through, I couldn't move my mouth. I couldn't move. It was weird.
That'd be interesting to know if the wind chill is representative of what your body's actually going through. Because if it's 90 degrees but the humidity makes it like 95. You're, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but your body treats it like it's 95.
Yeah, that's true.
So I don't know. That's interesting. Yeah, the other way around.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know. Anyway, they say that anything above 20 is definitely fine for most people. Although my son has something called Raynaud's phenomenon, which means that his fingers will turn blue at like 40 degrees.
Really?
Yes. And so it's relatively dangerous for him to be out there if it's really, really cold without some kind of protection on, for sure. And so I think it's different for everybody.
Yeah.
And so here's a totally different question. What do you feel like is okay to run in? That's the real question, right? That we all need to answer is what's comfortable enough for you? Now, me, I'm going outside.
Yeah.
Like you said, we're in Georgia. I'm going outside. I'm not, you know. Now, if it's cold and rainy, I might run inside in the treadmill. Yeah. Otherwise, I'm going outside. I don't care what the temperature is. So, and now, if you say, I don't want to run outside if it's under 40 degrees, fine.
Yeah,
we're not saying you're wrong. That's fine. You do what you feel comfortable with, and if you have a treadmill inside and you can get your work on inside with a treadmill, more power to you. I just don't like it. I hate a treadmill so much.
Yeah,
I might go out and run outside when it's rainy and 35 before I run on a treadmill.
See, I don't think I mind the treadmill as bad as you. I will run outside even if I have to put leggings on. But if I'm still a little cold with leggings on, that's where you draw the line. Because I'm not a huge hater on the treadmill. I kind of enjoy it sometimes.
Yeah. I guess I ran on the treadmill for a while at one time. I had a treadmill right outside my office where I worked.
Oh yeah.
And so I frequently would want to hang around. I was a manufacturing manager basically.
Oh. Okay.
Really, it was a shipping. But anyway, I was in an area that was shift work. And so I would want to hang around for all the shifts. And so that was a way for me to kind of kill some time, get my run in, and be there for that later shift. And
you had a treadmill tired. At – really? I thought you meant like at your house.
No.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah, I had one literally. You had to walk through the exercise room to get to my office.
Really?
Yeah, pretty impressive. Huh.
Upward Sports equips churches to run self-sustaining sports ministries in their communities. Whether you're a sports fanatic or on staff at a church, Upward Sports will give you all the tools you need to run a first-class sports ministry that allows you to reach families in your community. Upward Sports offers basketball, soccer, flag football, cheerleading, volleyball, baseball, and softball through league and camp offerings. At Upward Sports, we want to help your church make a difference and give you increased opportunities to share the gospel. Learn more today at upward.org. That's upward.org.
All right, we're back. And I got this story about Rory Coleman. You ever heard of Rory Coleman? He's an English guy from Great Britain. He just ran his 1,229th marathon. Actually, by the time I'm reading this, he's probably run more than that because he runs so many. He holds multiple world records. He's 63 years old. He just ran a marathon that we mentioned back a couple of months ago. It's the Garpenberg Zinc Mine Marathon in Sweden. It's 3,669 feet below sea level. It's the lowest marathon in the world. So they ran this loop that was in this mine that was a little over 2 miles long, and it was all uphill one direction, all downhill the other direction. And this guy, Rory Coleman, ran that race along with 54 other people, and this was the first time they had run this race. So it's the world's lowest marathon. Can you believe that?
I wonder if the oxygen level is you know how like if you go up in elevation, I wonder if the oxygen level is even denser down there.
I would think the air is thick. It was, I think they said it's really humid down there.
Oh, okay.
and it's warm down there.
Yeah.
So
and it's in a coal mine.
Yeah.
So that probably doesn't.
Well,
or did it say Coleman? Zinc mine.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Either way, it's kind of down a corridor. And so the idea of just running up and down a corridor for 26.2 miles, woo, that'll play with your mind, won't it? Oh, man. Anyway, this guy, Rory Coleman's pretty cool. Pretty cool guy. He's run the Marathon des Sables, which is the running across the Sahara Desert. He's run it 18 times. And what's interesting about this guy is he has overcome, I never know how to say this, Guillain-Barré syndrome. I'm not sure how to say it, but I think we've all heard of it. It attacks the nervous system. He had to learn how to walk again. Hmm. And after he took his first four steps of learning how to walk again, he ran a park run like a week later, and then he ran a marathon like a couple months later.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that crazy? So this was his 250th marathon since that diagnosis. So congratulations to the 55 people who finished the world's deepest marathon. Well, it's been a few years since I wrote this story. Every year, I say I'm going to write another Christmas story. And I've started a couple of times, but I can never get into it. Yeah. I don't know why. But if you've not heard this story, it's definitely one of my better writings. It's substantially longer than our normal story of the week. So we're not going to do the standard three scriptures and three questions that we normally do. We will take a few minutes to discuss it, though, which will be the first time we've ever done that before. So instead of reading it again, what I'm going to do is I'm going to insert the audio and video from where we did it last year. So I hope you enjoy The Night That Changed Everything. Frank Blunt didn't believe in anything good, maybe not even himself. Christmas came for each of his 38 years on Earth, but he had seen nothing to persuade him that it was anything more than greed that drove the gift-giving season. He reasoned that giving only happened when there was an expectation to receive something in return. Frank didn't believe in the general goodness of the men and women he had in contact with every day of his life in the insurance business. Even as he interacted with clients, he could see the greed as they bickered about a dollar here and a dollar there. He was sure people didn't want to simply give things away for the sake of giving. There was an additional motive in each case. Frank didn't care for rich people who seemed to flaunt their wealth and only allowed the occasional crumb to fall to those who really needed it, as they lived behind walls protected from anything the world might do to infiltrate their wealthy lifestyle. Greed, indeed. But he also didn't care for poor people. Why couldn't these people get a job? They would rather beg for money on the side of the road than find a real job that required some commitment to be punctual and contribute to society. It was greed in a different form, he thought. They didn't want to endure the inconvenience of responsibility. It was lazy greed. The people who irritated him most were those Christians. They claimed to be motivated by a mystical being who lived 2,000 years ago in the form of a man called Jesus Christ. Seriously? He thought. It seemed pathetic to him that adults would behave or would believe in fairy tales. Still, Frank was sure that they were motivated by the need for recognition for the things they would do to help others. It was still greed, only fed through a need to feel less guilty about who they were. Frank Blunt believed in Frank Blunt. Good or bad, it was all he could count on. Frank's sister Joy had tried numerous times over the years to break through his shell of skepticism. She feared that she had never made a dent or created so much as a pinhole. The shell had proven to be very durable over the years. Still, Joy had prayed thousands of times for Frank and his salvation. If God could soften his heart even a little, maybe he could see that most people are not what he thought them to be. As Christmas approached, she asked God to give her a pick to break through that shell. But as soon as the Christmas-related conversation began, Frank would retreat to his shell and defend his feelings vehemently. "Christmas is all about giving, Frank," Joy would say. "Yeah, sure, I know. Just so people can help other people and make them feel good, right?" "It's more than that, Frank. God gave his son the most incredible gift ever given. On Christmas, we celebrate that gift, in part by giving to others. but we also simply remember the gift and celebrate what God did for us. Imagine giving your son. Can there be anything more gracious than that? Oh, here we go again, Frank said. Christmas is all about greed, not some sense of benevolence. If you don't believe me, just look at how people act on Black Friday. Last year, someone shot in a dispute over a toy. The year before that, a 62-year-old woman wound up in the hospital because she was trampled at the door because people had to get to those big screen TVs that were on sale. If that's the giving spirit, then I don't want any part of it. Those words triggered a thought in Joy's mind. The giving spirit, she thought. She had an idea. She asked, so you think there is really no such thing as the giving spirit, as you called it? Of course not, Frank said. Giving is easy when you know you're going to get something in return. It's a guiltless way to accumulate more stuff. Nobody gives things away without some expectation of a return on their investment. Joy said, I have a proposal for you, Frank. Yeah, what is that? I want to challenge you to give something away. Easy, as long as it's not my stuff I'm giving away, Frank said. Okay, so here's my challenge. I will give you $100 to give away, but there are stipulations to who and how you give it away. First, you can only give away $5 at a time. No matter how much a person may need, you can only give them $5. You can give them less if you like, but no more than $5 per person. Second, you have to give the money to someone you believe needs it. There has to be some reason, justifiable or not, that you give the money away. Third, anyone you give the money to has to be someone that you have never met before. Joy finished. What do you think? I think that's an easy assignment. I don't see the point, but if it'll make my baby sister happy for me to give her money away, then I'm more than happy to oblige, Frank said sarcastically. And you will see, the world is full of unappreciative, greedy people. I may get a thank you or two, but only because it's the polite thing to do. In the end, you'll be out $100 and nothing will be different. But I have one stipulation of my own. Once I'm done for the rest of this year, you can't try to convince me that people are good or that there is some guy named Jesus who I need to get to know better. Deal? Deal, Joy exclaimed. I'm willing to take the chance. You only have to promise me that when Jesus shows up, you will acknowledge it. Okay, if the 2,000-year-old man shows up, I'll let you know, Frank retorted. The next day, Frank found himself wondering how he'd gotten into such a strange situation. How exactly would he identify people who needed the money? Where would he start? He had already been to the bank and exchanged Joy's $100 bill for $25 bills. 20 people, $5 each. This should only take an hour or so, he thought. Downtown. How many times had he been approached by people who were living on the street and asked for spare change? He could capture all 20 of those needy people in a few square blocks. That would be the most efficient avenue to shut his sister up for the rest of the year. As he drove to the parking lot, he identified four vagrants, as he liked to call them, along the way. He parked the car and immediately saw a group of three men huddled in the corner of the parking garage. They were sitting on upside-down buckets and seemed to be joking with each other. It seemed clear that they were only there because they were trying to keep warm by staying out of the wind. Their clothing and demeanor persuaded him that they may be homeless. They would qualify for a handout according to Joy's rules. Frank approached them and asked them if they would each like $5. One of them looked at him and said, "What's the catch?" He said, "No catch, $5, in the spirit of Christmas." "Just for free?" they asked suspiciously. "That's right," Frank confirmed. "Well, how about $20 then?" another asked coyly, confirming Frank's paradigm of a greedy world. Here he was giving money away, and it just wasn't enough. "No, just $5. He reached into his pocket, peeled off three $5 bills, and handed them out. The guys high-fived each other. He might be done in less than an hour at this rate. As he walked away from the group, he mustered up as much sarcasm as he could and said, "Merry Christmas." He left the parking facility, walking north, and found a lady on a bench laying under some cardboard trying to sleep. There was a shopping cart filled with her belongings next to her. The cart was tethered to her arm by a rope tied around her wrist. Why would people choose to live this way? Frank thought. He approached her and said, "Ma'am, can I ask you a question?" "Sure," she said suspiciously. "Could I interest you in a $5 bill?" "Oh, no, thank you," she said firmly. "Seriously, you can't use $5? "Well, of course I can, but I haven't done anything to deserve it. I can't just take your money." "What if you consider it a Christmas gift?" "But you don't even know me. Why would you give me a gift?" She had not received a Christmas gift in 2 years. "I insist." He took another $5 bill from his pocket and handed it to her. She looked at the bill as if it were priceless. A tear formed in her eye and a smile on her face as she said, "I prayed for this. God has sent you to me, I'm certain." Frank knew the truth, that his sister had sent him. He elected not to vocalize that fact and even wished he could give her more money. But rules were rules. Again, he said, "Merry Christmas." Only this time much less sarcastically, and it may have even felt good to say it this time. He had found the one person who appreciated receiving a gift. What were the odds, he thought. He moved on and began to realize that the homeless were more difficult to find than he had thought. He walked a few blocks before seeing a man just ahead who was going from one pedestrian to another asking for money. This one would be easy. As he approached the man, he was anticipating the question. Only the question was different than he thought it would be. The man said, "Could you buy me some food? I haven't had anything to eat today." So much for the rumor that all of the homeless are alcoholics looking for their next drink. Frank said, "How about if I give you $5 and you can go get something to eat?" He handed him the bill, looking deep into his eyes as they brightened with the news. The man smiled and with heartfelt gratitude he said, "Oh, thank you so much, sir." Frank smiled back at him and again said, "Merry Christmas." That one felt pretty good. As Frank was about to walk off, the man said, "Sir, may I ask you a question?" Frank thought, "Why do you have to ruin a good interaction by forcing me to have a conversation?" But instead said, "Sure, but I can't give you any more money." "Oh, that's fine. Sir, are you an angel?" Well, Frank didn't know what to say. He didn't believe there was such a thing as an angel. "No," he said, surprising himself with his calmness. "Why do you ask?" "Well, it just seems that you're different from everyone else I see on the street. You looked at me like I was somebody. Most people are always trying to do anything but make eye contact with me. They hope that I won't approach them. I wish I didn't have to, but I don't know what else to do. But you're different. You seem to be eager to help me. I thought maybe you were an angel sent by God to help me. Anyway, thank you so much for your kindness. Have a Merry Christmas." Suddenly, those words, "Merry Christmas," rang in his head. He had wished these poor people, down-and-out people, a Merry Christmas. What did they have to be merry about? He was going to go home in an hour and sleep in a warm bed tonight while these people would sleep in the cold or in a room with 50 others in a shelter somewhere. But this guy just wished Frank a Merry Christmas. The seemingly incongruous phrase was not lost on him. As he walked around the town, he had many more similar interactions and conversations. He began to feel more comfortable speaking with these people. With each one, he felt a little more compassion. He didn't know why these people were living the way they did, but one thing was sure, it's not what they would have chosen if given a better and more comfortable choice. Most of them really had no choice. The thought of having to live on the streets began to run through his mind. He didn't know if he was tough enough to do it. Many of the conversations revolved around God and angels or other spiritual matters. If these people did believe in God, and it seemed clear that they did, why would they rely so heavily on a being that had left them in the circumstances in which they were living? But even as the thought came to him, the answer bounced back quickly. Well, what else did they have? God was all they could rely on.
Frank had never had so much compassion for people he didn't know. For that matter, he had never had any compassion for those he didn't know. By the time he had given out 17 of the 20 $5 bills he had in his pocket, he was losing track of time. He was enjoying the conversations and the idea of helping those who needed it. Sure, there were a few who were scammers and just looking for a few extra bucks, but the overwhelming majority of them were hurting. He began to hope that his words were soothing to them. He actually wanted to help. By this time, it had been 2.5 hours and the sun was going down. It was getting colder. He approached number 18, an older, thin, gray-haired lady who was missing her false teeth, and he gave her the money. She asked if she could pray with him. He reluctantly agreed. If it would make her feel better, he was willing to go along. She prayed, "Lord, thank you so much for sending this man my way tonight. You knew how much I needed it, and you provided. I praise your name for your goodness. Lord, bless this man. I don't know who he is, but you are surely using him tonight as your servant. I pray that even as he blesses those around him, that you will see fit to bless him with your goodness and mercy. Amen." Frank thought for a moment and couldn't think of anyone who had ever prayed with him alone before. Once again, someone with far less than most seemed to have something that he clearly did not. Though he had grown more compassionate through this process, he knew that if he were in their circumstances, he could not be as positive as many of them were. "Thank you for that. I hope you have a Merry Christmas. Do you have a warm place to sleep tonight?" The words startled him as they fell from his mouth. What was he going to do if she said no? But she let him off the hook and said, "I'm heading for a shelter in a few minutes. They don't open the doors until 6 p.m. "Great," he said in relief. As Frank turned in search of number 19, he noticed a man looking at him from across the street. He was clearly not one of the homeless he was looking for, but the man kept watching him. When he caught Frank looking his way, he waved and looked both ways as he crossed the street. He was headed straight towards Frank. "Oh no," Frank thought as he wondered if he was someone of authority who was going to tell him that he couldn't do what he was doing. Was he in some sort of trouble? The man reached the other side of the street and said, "Do you have a minute, sir?" "Depends. What do you want to tell me?" Frank said with more than a hint of suspicion. The man continued, "My name is Wilbur Rexall III. I have seen what you have been doing for the last hour or so. Are you giving money to the homeless in this community? Because that's precisely what it looks like you're doing." Growing more suspicious, Frank said, "Why is that any of your business? You're not with the police department, are you? I'm not doing anything illegal, am I?" The questions kept coming to him and spilling out of his mouth. "Oh, no, sir. I own 3 businesses downtown, and I spend a lot of time people watching. I couldn't help but notice the very deliberate way you were walking from one person to another, not only giving them money, but taking time to speak with each of them for a couple of minutes. In the 30 years I have been around here, I don't believe I have ever witnessed such a display of individual generosity." Frank was put on the spot. He knew his motive for doing what he was doing had begun in far from charitable way. He was only trying to prove something to his sister. Still, he had softened his stance considerably by this time. He was much closer to the right motive by now, but he was still looking for number 20 so he could get in his nice car and drive to his warm house. "Well, just trying to help those less fortunate than myself, you know," Frank said, immediately feeling guilty for the way he took credit for what it was he was doing. It wasn't even his money he was giving away. Mr. Rexall asked, "Do you own a house?" What an odd question, Frank thought, but answered, "Yes, sir. It's about 10 miles from here." The stranger continued his line of questioning. "How much money do you owe on your house?" "Well, that's kind of a private matter, Mr. Rexall. Is that what you said your name was?" Frank was sure to reply in a manner that said, "Back off, mister." "Yes, sir. Wilbur Rexall III. I suppose it is forward of me to ask such a question out of the blue, so let me explain. The Lord has blessed me far beyond anything I could ever have expected. I grew up poor and spent time on the street just like the people you have been talking with this evening. I'm not going to live forever, and I can't take all that money with me. I would like to pay off your mortgage, sir, if you would allow it. What? What did he just say? Frank wondered if being out in the cold air for a couple of hours could alter your hearing in some way. Excuse me? He said. Oh, I'm terribly sorry if I've offended you in some way. I only wanted to return the kind gesture that you are so graciously offering to these people. No, I mean, seriously, what did you just ask me? Frank said, still trying to gather himself. I'd like your permission to pay off your mortgage, sir. That's what Frank thought he had heard. You can't possibly be serious, he asked incredulously. Well, yes, sir, I am being serious. As I said, I have been so blessed by God, and I feel his urging to do this for you. Frank's mind was going a million miles an hour. It was almost as if this man knew that he had been struggling to make ends meet lately. Although he was not behind on his mortgage, he had some bill collectors calling his house for other bills that were delinquent. Not having a mortgage payment would allow him to catch up every other bill he had due. That's an incredible gesture, sir, but why would you do such a thing? Frank asked. As I told you, I have a soft spot for the homeless. As a matter of fact, I own a small warehouse around the block that I open up every year when the weather gets cold so that the homeless have a place to go. I open it at 6 o'clock every night and serve them some soup or some other small meal so they can help them keep them going for the next day. For many of them, the next day is really all they have to look forward to. I see myself lying on those cots, and I know that those nights are cold, and I appreciate the man who opened up his warehouse for me almost 40 years ago. Without that man's generosity, I might have frozen to death on one of those cold nights. I also think about Mary and Joseph under similar circumstances. They had no place to stay except for the generosity of a man who offered his stable as a warm place to stay for the night. To make matters worse, poor Mary was pregnant and about to give birth. The Savior of the world was born under circumstances not far removed from the homeless shelter of today. We never know who we help. It could be a young man who would wind up owning several businesses one day, and he may decide to give back to those who helped him and those who are helping those who are like he once was. Or it could be even bigger than that. The man who offered his stable had no idea that Jesus would be born under his generosity, but that's what happened. No, sir, you have no idea who you have helped tonight with your simple gestures of money and conversation. You may have changed someone's life tonight. That, sir, is why I would do such a thing. Frank took it all in and was overwhelmed by it all. Every paradigm he had ever believed was challenged in this moment. Poor people weren't who they thought they were. Now he finds out that rich people aren't the greedy scumbags he thought they were. Even crazier, this man had him intrigued about that whole Jesus story, as crazy as it was. He wanted to know more. Do you really believe the Jesus story? It's so incredible that it seems impossible, Frank said. It not only seems impossible, it was impossible for humans. That's how we know it was God himself who wrote the story. Oh, I'm certain of the authenticity of the story. Not only do I know it is true because of what he has done for me, but if you will spend some honest time looking at the facts, you will come to the same conclusion that it has to be true. It sounds like you're not a believer. Frank answered, well, I like to think I'm a common sense guy who thinks practically. It's awfully hard to square a virgin birth with scientific reality, not to mention being raised from the dead. Mr. Rexall answered, I completely understand. I was right where you are a long time ago. It didn't make sense to me either. But that man who opened his warehouse for me all those years ago also gave me my first Bible. I was homeless and didn't have much to do besides looking for a job, so I scoured that Bible looking for loopholes at first. When I could find none, I began to see the facts. Do you know that the prophet Isaiah predicted the birth of Jesus hundreds of years before it happened, and with some detail, I might add? If the Jesus story is not true, how did that happen? Yes, sir. Being practical will only lead you to believe in Jesus. So up is down, and backwards is forwards, Frank thought. Everything he believed was wrong according to this man. He seemed to be a normal man. He had no agenda that Frank could see. In the span of a few hours, his entire life felt like it was changing. Mr. Rexall continued, "If you want proof of the reality of God, look no further than the fact that you and I are standing here speaking. Do you think it is mere coincidence that I saw you, what you were doing this evening? Think about the conversations you had with those people this evening. Do you see God in any of those when you look at it from His perspective?" "I don't know what to say, sir." "Yes, I do see where it is possible that a God could have coordinated what happened tonight, but it seems so crazy. Why would a God who could do so much be interested in me? I've done nothing but make fun of Christians for years. Surely He has much better things to do tonight," Frank concluded. "No, Frank, He doesn't. You see, that's the most incredible thing about God. He loves every one of us, whether we love Him back or not. Tonight, you were the most important person on His mind, as were billions of other people. He knew this day was coming before you were even born. We can't understand that in our finite minds, but it's true. God has always been around you, but it looks like maybe you can see Him tonight. Am I right?" Mr. Rexall's question pierced Frank's heart. Frank answered reluctantly, "It's hard to explain it any other way, I suppose." "Listen, Frank, I can tell you're struggling with the enormity of it all, but that's how God works. I see it all the time. And if you will too, you will too if you choose to believe and live a life for Him." Frank said much more boldly now, "Honestly, this has been the most incredible night of my life. I want to have more days like this one. How do I go about doing that? What do I have to do next?" Wilbur Rexall led Frank Blunt through several verses about God's salvation plan from the book of Romans, a.k.a. the Roman Road. It still seemed impossible to Frank that he had felt so differently just a few hours prior, but after what he had seen and heard that night, he knew nothing was impossible with God. Frank drove home and couldn't wait to talk with Joy. He realized that he still had $10 of hers in his pocket. He didn't complete his assignment. Or did he? When he walked into Joy's house, he had the biggest smile she had ever seen. "Oh, no," she thought. "He must have given away all the money, and now he's happy that he doesn't have to hear any more about Jesus for the rest of the year." "Sis," Frank said, "I owe you my life." Startled by this comment, she asked, "Well, what do you mean?" "God didn't just show up tonight. He showed off," Frank exclaimed. They talked about the evening for nearly 2 hours. Eventually, as time ran off the clock, it was time to go home and go to bed. It was an incredible day that Frank would certainly never forget. It was difficult to fall asleep, but he did, only after saying a prayer before bedtime for the first time in his life. At work the next day, he was still giddy about the prior evening's activity and the result of meeting an incredible bunch of people. He couldn't stop telling everyone he met about what had happened. He wasn't very productive as the world would measure it, but God doesn't use the same measures as the world. Lunch hour came, and he used the time to check his email. In the list of messages was a communication from a bank. He clicked on the message and was astounded by what he saw. As Mr. Rexall had promised, it was an email congratulating him for paying off his mortgage. In all this excitement, Frank had forgotten about the promise. But he had only told him his name and who the lien holder was on his home. How had he been able to complete the transaction so quickly? He thought he would need to give him more information if he was still going to insist on paying off his mortgage. But Mr. Rexall was apparently a very well-connected man. Frank wanted to personally thank him, not only for the debt release, but more importantly for changing his life's direction. But in all the excitement of the moment, he never asked where his office was located. Well, no matter. If he owned 3 businesses downtown, he would be able to find him. Later, he went back to the same place he saw him the day before, but he was not there. He went inside several establishments, but oddly, found no one who knew him. Frank remembered the night shelter Mr. Rexall opened. If he could find the shelter, he would almost certainly be able to find him. He went into one more place, and sure enough, a lady knew where the shelter was located. He walked 3 blocks to the shelter, entered, and looked for someone who appeared to be in charge. He found a man who was helping to serve some food, waited for a break, and asked where he could find Mr. Rexall. The man asked, "Who?" "Mr. Rexall," Frank said, "the man who owns this building." "Oh, you must be mistaken. This building is not owned by anyone with that name. I've never heard that name before." The man seemed absolutely sure of himself. "Well, that's odd. No one seems to know who Mr. Rexall is." "Thank you for your time," Frank said dejectedly. As he began to walk away, he turned and asked, "What is the man's name who owns this building if it's not Mr. Rexall?" "Well, his name is Gabriel, you know, like the angel. He prefers folks call him Gabe, though. Something about not wanting to draw attention to himself." All Frank could get out was, "Yes, that's just like Mr. Rexall. I mean, Gabe."
So what do you think of the story? You've heard it before.
I have heard it, yeah.
Yeah.
I really like it.
Yeah.
It's not just like a good writing. It's a very well, in my opinion, like, thought out story. Like, I knew that you wrote, and I knew that you know, but a few years ago, when I heard this one for the first time, it did kind of change my opinion about your writing a little bit. I was like, oh, wow, this, you know, I mean, it's pretty, like, not to, you know, big you up or anything, but I think it's really good.
Well, I appreciate that. So what's your favorite part of the story?
Well, definitely the end. I'm a sucker for a good, like, Christopher Nolan type, like, you know, you think one thing and then it's, so the end, I really like the end.
Yeah. Well, like I said, this is the first time we've ever discussed the story. And you can hear the music kicking in at the end of the story because normally we finish the podcast with the story. So this is really unusual for us to talk about it at all. So anyway, I appreciated writing it. And actually, you know, there's two stories, actually. You've only heard one of them.
Yeah.
But there was an original story, and then I wrote an alternate ending to that story. So
really?
This is the alternate ending story.
Huh.
Yeah. So...
That is pretty cool.
So what's your favorite thing about Christmas in general?
Oh, I just like literally everything about it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I like...
So you're on board with your dad putting the Christmas tree up in like September.
Oh, yeah. But here's one thing, though. I'm against him taking it down the day after Christmas because that's one thing y'all don't know. Or maybe y'all do know. But he talks about how he puts it up in September, but it is down December 26th.
That's true.
In the comments, I want y'all to go tell Mitchell Hollis to leave his tree up.
Till New Year's,
at least.
Yeah.
So, but no, I love Christmas. The lights, the music. I love the movies. I feel like some of them I've seen a million times, but like Elf and It's a Wonderful Life, I just...
Can't get enough.
Yeah, I would watch them... Yeah.
So let me ask you this. Do you want to guess how many Christmas movies Debbie and I have already watched this year?
How many?
How many would you think is possible to have watched by this time?
Possible. Today's December 12th.
Yeah.
So if you started watching the beginning of November, what would that be like, 43?
49.
What?
We have watched 49 Christmas movies so far. So our record is 60. We're going to break that.
Really?
This year. We're going to run right through that this year. Yeah.
Wow. Are they all different ones?
They're all different. And none of the ones we've watched this year are ones we've seen before.
That is actually pretty impressive. That is insane.
We search for, we love foreign Christmas movies.
Really?
So yes, look for, they're so different from our Christmas movies. So
really?
Look for Christmas movies that are actually made in a different language and then dubbed. And they're really fascinating to watch.
Have you watched any German ones?
I think, yes, one German one.
Yep. I don't know why I just thought of German. Our executive pastor was going to like Atlanta for some German Christmas thing. I don't even know what it was.
That's where Christmas started, right?
Germany?
Yeah.
Well, I don't
know. Yeah, I mean, the a lot of the traditions we have from Christmas, as I understand it, started
in
Germany.
I was about to say, I thought it started in Nazareth or something.
All the Christmas markets and stuff that are in.
Yeah.
I guess probably the truth is the commercialization of Christmas probably started.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Nazareth would have something to say about that.
So what you got some, yeah. Well, good point. What about traditions? You got any traditions that, that are just, you can't live without other than watching those two movies?
I mean, there's little things like, I mean, we always have like a Hollis get together either the 23rd or 24th. So that's always nice. There's just a few things. Christmas is one of those where we've never had like set in stone traditions. Okay. Other than, you know, like putting the tree up early, watching It's a Wonderful Life, yeah, whatever. Yeah. Now, we do have a family, a really big family that lives near us, and they pretty much go all out with Christmas lights. You know who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's a spectacle.
Yeah.
And so we go there and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. That's fun to do. Yeah.
I mean, it's like a full like drive through like horseshoe loop. I know, it's pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. It's really kind of cheesy in some ways, it but is. Really cool at the same time.
And the best part about it is they have this speaker that plays Christmas music, but the speaker is like super old. And so it sounds super old.
Yeah.
It's pretty great.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. You're kind of an old soul in some ways, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what we do at my house is we have Christmas breakfast. Mm. So I cooked last year 8 pounds of bacon.
Oh, wow. That's a lot.
Yes. And then we have biscuits and gravy, and we have eggs and egg casserole, and we have all sorts of different things for breakfast. And that's our big tradition, is to have Christmas breakfast.
Yeah.
We have it at lunchtime, but, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Christmas breakfast.
Yeah.
And then usually I like to read Luke chapter 2 mm-hmm. If we can get everybody there together and calm down enough to do that.
Yeah.
Those are the two things I like to do. This can also be kind of a really sad time of year for some people. My mother's grandfather died on Christmas Day back in, I think it's 1962. It was before I was born.
Yeah.
And that always came to her mind. And for a lot of people, there's a lot of people that associate grief with Christmas in some way. And for other people, maybe financially, they struggle and they don't have enough money for Christmas gifts and things, and that puts a little bit of pressure on, especially if they have kids.
Yeah,
it makes it really, really tough. And so I think it's important for us to recognize, and I always like to take time to pray for folks that are less fortunate or that are not happy on Christmas, because it almost makes me feel guilty to be so happy when you know there are people out there like that, right? So always keep them in mind too. Anyway, this story here talks about homeless people, and I know that I've way oversimplified the plight of those people for the purposes of this story, but I think there can be some truth to this. I do know this, though. I have a Sunday school class with a guy who has been a police officer, a state trooper. He's done a lot of law enforcement type things. And to listen to him talk about those people who are asking for money and stuff will make you depressed.
Yeah.
Because he basically says almost all of them are swindlers in one way or another. And that's sad. Mm. But here's the thing I want to say about that.
Like, as in they don't.
Like, they're not really.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
They're lying to you.
Yeah.
So I'll give you a good one. So when I was in New Jersey a couple of weeks ago with up there for my father's thing, I went to the grocery store one day, and a guy comes walking through the parking lot with a gas can under his arm that had no top on it. And he was telling me it was like a 1 gallon gas tank.
Yeah.
And he was trying to come up, he needed some money to get gas to travel somewhere, right? And it was just so clear by the way the words the guy was using, everything about the guy was clear that he was just trying to get some money. And I didn't give him any money. There's a lot of other times, though, I have given people money. I've given people money in a lot of different ways. And I know that some of them, I am sure, have taken my money and have used it for nefarious things.
Yeah.
That's not up to me to decide. I gave that money thinking, I hope you need it. And here's some money. And I feel like God honors it as long as our heart's in the right place.
Yeah.
So that's not up to us to decide afterwards, I think. And this made me think about something else that I don't know why this made me think of this, but should we support businesses who are hostile to Christianity? That whole idea of the swindler and the people who are hostile to Christianity, the Bible doesn't really address that. Do you have an opinion on that?
it's hard to say. If a company, I think, I guess me personally, if a company is openly hostile towards Christianity, because openly hostile and just like generally hostile, I feel like is two different things. I mean,
that's a good point.
The big, you know, trillion-dollar companies nowadays, they may not directly say, like, I have an iPhone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not maybe that they're, like, directly saying, directly being hostile towards Christianity. But, I mean, in a way, they can be.
Yeah.
Because of the things that
they support.
They push. If, yeah. If a company was openly hostile towards Christianity, I would probably feel uncomfortable buying something.
Yeah.
But it's hard for me to say that, like, I would never buy something from certain companies. Cause I mean, you know this, like, I mean, Apple and Nike and
yeah,
they definitely push values that are not Christian whatsoever, but I have both the products. So it's a line that, you know, you really have to, I guess, follow your convictions on, but
I think that was going to be my point. Was that I think it's all up to what you feel comfortable doing. And I think if you feel comfortable supporting Nike, then fine. I don't buy anything that has a Nike label on it. But that doesn't make me right and you wrong, or you right and me wrong.
Yeah.
I think it depends on what God puts on your heart. And I'm not saying that God puts the more correct thing on my heart.
Yeah,
I think it's, again, it goes back to what you do, what God convicts you to do. That's what you should do. And mm-hmm. I think that's it.
Yeah.
So the bottom line on this story, I think, is that we do need to help those who are less fortunate than us. And I think that we should be, especially this time of year, we should be going out and trying to find ways to help people. And if we're not doing that, then I think we're not fulfilling the Great Commission. I think that's something we should be doing. So from a young person's perspective, what do you think about that? Is that something you feel strongly about that you should do?
I mean, yeah, definitely.
Harder to do when you're young.
Yeah. It can be at certain points. But, I mean, especially as far as like financially, you know, at certain points in time. But a young person, like let's say you're in college or whatever, if you're in college, there's maybe a good chance you're in a city and there's going to be homeless people.
But you also have less money when you're young.
That's true. You have less money. I don't know. I think showing, because that's a big thing to, let's say it's a homeless person in a city who asks you for money, because that's happened to me a ton of times in Chattanooga when I was going to school there. there was the thought sometimes in my head, it's like, you know, well, I don't know what they're going to do with this money. And for me personally, it was like, is it that, or is it, I don't want to take the time to,
yeah,
to, there's a restaurant right there. And so there were several times where you just take them to go get a meal. There was a woman one time, I was at a gas station, and there was a woman who came up to me, and she was like, I need some money for breakfast. And I don't mean this in any certain way, but you could tell she was homeless. I mean, it was obvious. Or she was just a really good actor, you know. And I don't know. We went to Burger King. I told her, I said, walk across the street and I'll just meet you at Burger King. And it doesn't have to be this, like, you know, big ordeal that you give this, you know, person money or whatever. If your friend asked you, like, hey, you want to go to Burger King for breakfast? Well, you may not go to Burger King, but I don't know. It's as a person on campus, I think providing meals is a good way to do it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point.
Do you need something to keep you motivated to keep fit both physically and spiritually?
Upward Running has what you need to keep you on track for both. Check out upwardrunning.com and join us for pennies a day. I promise you, you will not regret it.
All right, it's time for Dean's Thoughts. That's a time when I share something that I've written about the intersection between running and faith. Well, don't you love a story with a twist? This one is really good. It's called Recognizing the Gift. A man stood in a Washington, D.C. metro station on a cold January morning during rush hour and played his violin for 45 minutes. Very few people stopped, though some did throw money in his till as they walked by, just over $32 worth, to be exact. If truth be told, it was a testament to the generosity of the people of D.C. that they were willing to throw a few dollars the way of a fairly talented musician, even if they didn't have time to stop and listen. Of the 1,097 people who walked by, only 7 stopped for any length of time to listen. Finally, at the end of the 45 minutes, a kind lady, one of the 7, waited for him to stop playing and told the violinist that she knew who he was because she had seen him at a fancy event once before. It turned out that violinist was the famous Joshua Bell, and he had been playing in some of the most difficult and beautiful pieces ever written on a $3.5 million Stradivarius violin. He was only a few days removed from playing in front of a sold-out theater in Boston where the tickets averaged $100 each. Here's my question to you. Do you recognize the gifts that are right in front of your eyes? All of those people who walked by Joshua Bell as he played missed out on a $100 ticket opportunity. What are you walking by? I submit to you that we take many important things for granted, and one of those things is our ability to get out and make ourselves healthier. Do you recognize the benefits of running or walking 4 or 5 times a week? Among the thousands of benefits that are reduced weight, better blood pressure and cholesterol, better sleep, and mental strength well above average, those things are serious game changers. So why do we have difficulty getting out the door sometimes? I think it's because we're walking past the violinist. Why do we think about how bad we hurt while we run instead of the good things that we're doing for our health? It's because we don't want to pay attention to the guy in the corner playing that infernal instrument. We'd rather look at one of the best violinists in the world as a nuisance than to stop and admire what he is doing. Or maybe you're the person who throws a few dollars in the till. You appreciate the benefits of running, and you prove it by saying the right things about it. But do you really believe those things? If you do, great. If not, you can start today. If not, recognize the gift you have been given, and it can transform your activity in ways you haven't seen yet. It's a big deal. Treat it like one. Of course, we do the same thing with our spiritual lives. The gift that Jesus gave us 2,000 years ago on the cross is the greatest gift ever given, but sometimes we fail to tell people about it. I have to ask myself, have I told as many people about Jesus lately as I have about the great new running shoe I'm wearing? Don't get me wrong, the shoes are great, but they're nothing compared to Jesus. Just acknowledging Jesus is great is not enough. It's a great start. But if I truly believe Jesus is who he says he is, and I do, why am I not sharing it with everyone? That's a convicting question, to be sure. So as you step away from this story and back into your own busy metro station, remember that the music is already playing all around you. The gift of a healthy body and the greater gift of salvation in Christ are right in front of you, waiting to be noticed, embraced, and shared. Don't rush past them or toss them a token nod on your way to the next thing. Stop, listen, and respond by lacing up your shoes, opening your mouth in a joyless witness, and by living each day as if these gifts truly are the treasures we know them to be. You ever heard that story before?
I have not.
Isn't that crazy?
No, yeah.
I mean, you can imagine it for sure.
I've seen things like it.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, those things are pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, what's really interesting about this particular story is that this was a recreation of the exact same thing being done in Chicago 70 years prior. I can't remember the guy's name. There was a guy that did it. Another famous violinist did the same thing in Chicago 70 years earlier. And here's the most interesting part of the story. He was playing the exact same violin. This violin was a 1713 Stradivarius violin. I mean, a priceless instrument. And this guy did it 70 years prior using when that guy was on it, I guess on his deathbed, I don't know, but this Joshua Bell bought this violin from that guy.
Yeah. So that is pretty crazy.
Isn't that pretty neat? I think it's cool.
I can just imagine if Etta James was like singing in a subway station, most people would probably walk by her.
Yeah.
Just never, not me.
Yeah.
That is crazy.
So you think you'd notice somebody if they were there and they were talented and they were playing?
Oh, I mean, it depends on who it is. I mean, there's so many good, I'll have to admit, there's so many good singers nowadays. I may walk past a good singer. I will stop. I love some good singing. But there's a lot of older artists that I would definitely recognize.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I guess that this...
It is interesting that only one person out of 1,000 recognized this guy as famous as he is.
Yeah.
So, of course, I wouldn't have recognized him personally.
Oh, I probably wouldn't have either.
Yeah, because I don't follow that type of music. But
yeah, yeah.
So, anyway. So, you know, you're kind of in a unique position for this story right now. You've had this big purpose of running for many years. You just talked about how for the first time since you were 5, you weren't in serious training.
Yeah.
So today you're running for a whole different reason. So what's the reason you run today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different reasons, but also the kind of... So I used to run, I guess, for... because I do think... Well, one reason is still kind of the same, but one reason was kind of aspiration for career. And a little bit before I got married... graduating college, that kind of started to shift. And so now you could say that I run for fitness, but there's a lot of things that you can do for fitness. And I think I've said this, I may have said this before, but running to me, now this isn't always the case, but I often do feel pretty close to God when I run. Yeah. That's not always the case, and I really do just genuinely enjoy running. But I mean, some of my, you know, and some people may say, oh well, it's just a running high. I don't think so. Some of the best moments has been running, and you can almost feel, you know, the presence of God. And I don't mean to say that you can't do that elsewhere. But sometimes God just shows up in your life in different ways for different people.
Yeah.
And endurance sports is definitely a way that he shows up in my personal life. So.
Yeah, yeah, I totally agree with you. But there's also the idea of being fit as well.
Oh, right? Yeah. Oh,
that,
yeah.
That too.
Don't get it twisted. I really like to be fast.
Yeah.
Like I do want to run fast.
Yeah.
So
why do you think so many people ignore all the evidence that exercise is good for you? It'll make you feel better. It'll make you live a better life. And it's there's just so much out there. Why do you think it is that people don't pay any attention to that, it seems?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it can be a nuisance if you think about it in that way. But
I think a lot of people look at people who are, they look healthy and they don't do any kind of exercise, and they look at that person, they think, well, if that person can do it, then I can do it. I really think a lot of people's motivation is the fact that there are so many people out there that do seem to be healthy that don't exercise, and so they think that it's okay because of that.
Yeah, well, and a lot of people are just driven by like aesthetics nowadays, which is, it's just not... Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's just not a good representation of how healthy. I mean, I think one of the biggest like age predictors nowadays is your VO2 max.
That's right.
And that does not always show up in aesthetics. I mean, it does not.
That is a fact.
So sometimes the results and how they show up sometimes aren't appealing to people, you know, in certain ways.
Well, and it's hard. It's hard. Yeah. So I think the fact that it's hard makes people shy away from it. People don't like to do hard things if they don't have to. It's a lot easier to sit on the couch and watch Christmas movies.
Yeah.
Like I've been doing.
Yeah.
So.
And they want to see results. I mean, I heard something recently that is a pretty good, if you are someone who's getting into fitness or whatever, people often overestimate. There's a time periods on this saying, but I'm not going to add a time period. People overestimate what they can do in the short term and underestimate what they can do in the long term. Well,
that's a good way to put it.
When you get started, you're probably going to overestimate what you can do in 30 days, but you're going to severely underestimate what you can do in a year if you're consistent. And so I feel like people do want this, like, you know, I'm going to be a different person in 2 months. Is that may be the case. But if you give yourself a bit more of a timeline,
yeah,
you could see some serious change.
That's good stuff there. Yeah, I, going back to this story, the thing that I see in this story is that there are things that we need to stop for throughout life all the time. Mm-hmm. And we're so busy. You know, at one time, you know, I was coaching in college. You know, we were out of town 10 or 12 times a year on the weekends that took up full weekends. Not to mention the time that I spent with them every single day at practice.
Yeah.
And then I was also coaching at the high school. So it's like I was going to practices that lasted 3 hours because it was high school and then college or college and then high school. And that was every day. And then, you know, I'm a deacon at the church, a Sunday school teacher. I run the production at our church and stuff like that. And I run a program that feeds kids at a local elementary school and all those three things. And so for 3 years of that, too, I was also a town council person. And the truth is that at that time, if I had walked by Joshua Bell playing that violin, no way I would have stopped.
Yeah.
I was just too busy getting from one thing to the next. And if he happened to be on my route, there was no way I was going to stop because I didn't have any time in my schedule to stop. And I think it's really important for us to build time into our schedule to be able to stop and not miss things like this thing right here. Don't you think?
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. It is the time... The built-in time in your life for a sense of like wonder almost. Like,
yeah, that's like, a good way to put it.
But yeah.
Yeah. And listen, some people can't. I've given up the coaching stuff and the town council stuff. And if you can't give anything up, I get it. I totally understand. If you're busy because you have to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people, that they don't have a choice. And I get that. I totally get it. But man, I'm not condemning you at all. But man, if you can find a way to have that sense of wonder for the things that are around you, man, it can make a big difference in life.
Have you always wanted to read through the entire Bible but never found the time to do it? Well, let me do it for you. Sign up for the self-paced Bible in a Year challenge and start listening today. Every day, I read a few chapters from the Bible and give you helpful tips and encouraging quotes. You must be an Upward Running member for access to this exciting challenge. So if you're not a member, sign up today and get started. If you are a member, what are you waiting for?
Every week I share a reason why running and walking are so awesome. And this is this week's. It gives you something to share with old friends. Let me tell you what I mean by that. Lane, you have been busy with life over the last few years, you know, but we haven't spent much time together. But prior to that, we spent a lot of time together, right?
Yeah.
At practices and doing all the things that we do and sharing a lot of stuff about running and specifically about triathlon in general. And it was always fun to have those discussions and to talk. But we can not see each other for a year. And then come back together, and it's like we have this common bond.
Yeah.
Running is this common thing that we can talk about. Yeah. Or, you know, I sent you a text message earlier this week because Alex Yee, who's a triathlete, ran a 206 marathon, which is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, I can't wait to share that with Lane.
Yeah.
Because he's my triathlon guy I got to share stuff with.
Yeah.
Right? And I guess you get that with other things. You know, like people who hunt, mm-hmm. I'm sure they have that common bond as well. Yeah. But we've always said that people who suffer together, and we suffer together in running,
yeah.
it forms a little bit tighter bond
yeah.
than a lot of other things do. So that's why I think it's great. So did you hear the story about the course cutting on the NCAA cross country?
No.
No, not at all. Nope. Oh, wow. Okay. Well, here's what happens. So they run the NCAA cross country championship. NCAAs is a big, big deal, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they did not put up any flagging or anything on a couple of the turns where they had shorter grass that they ran on, and then there was a little bit long, like, you know, 3-4 inch grass.
Yeah.
And then there was really, really tall grass they couldn't go through.
Yeah.
But there were dozens of people running through that intermediate grass, cutting that curve.
Really?
And I'm sure they were kind of forced in by the by the crowd, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a little bit muddy, so I'm sure they were probably looking for better footing as well.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Should those people be disqualified or not?
Were there cones?
Nope. There was a painted line on the ground.
Oh, there was a painted line.
There was a painted line on the ground.
Okay. I mean, it's hard to say. What? No painted line? Absolutely. That's on the race. That's on the race director's. Painted line? I don't know. I mean, these people run meets. They run big meets. How many people cut?
Dozens. Many.
I mean, here's the thing. Do you think any of the big contenders had an advantage from the cutting?
I don't think anybody got an advantage from it, personally.
Yeah.
Just looking at it myself. But you know, back in 100th place, it could have made 1 second difference that, you know, could have helped somebody, possibly. I don't know. But
yeah, I mean,
I think there were too many, first of all. Second of all, to me, it's on race officials to make sure you can't do that.
That is true. I mean, even the races that I went to, like we never went to NCAAs, but we would go to, you know, Southeast Regionals and in Alabama, and they had flags on the curves. Yeah. And if you were to penalize someone, you'd end up having to penalize like 30, 40 people, and it wouldn't change the top 10 anyways.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but yeah, that's...
yeah. I bet they have some flags or something up next time.
Yeah. Double flags.
Well, this past week they had the U.S. Cross Country Championships, and it was pretty exciting to watch. Parker Wolf he and Rocky Hansen kind of battled each other there for a while, and then he just ran away from him toward the end. Did you see it?
I didn't see it, but I was interested looking at these times.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not an easy course. It was muddy. It was really muddy.
Yeah.
And they ran really well. The interesting thing to me was that Nico Young and Graham Blanks were fifth and sixth.
Yeah.
To me, they were the two favorites. It was which one of those guys was going to win. And then Parker Wolf and Rocky Hansen go toe-to-toe. And Wesley Kiptoo wasn't far behind. Ahmed Muhammad also was in that top five. So
I didn't know Paul Chelimo was still doing stuff like this.
He's been running marathons. That's the crazy thing is he's been running marathons, and then he shows up. And
yeah.
Paul Chelimo's always been one of those guys. He doesn't mind mixing it up, doing anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen his marathon training and whatnot. When I saw him on this list, I was like, oh, wow, he just does whatever.
Pretty cool. And on the women's side, Wayne Colati was the class of the field. I mean, Katie Izzo put up a pretty good fight trying to hang with her as much as she could. But in the end, Wayne was just way too strong for everybody else in the race. And then Edna Kurgott was third, Carisha Switzer, and then Emily Venters, and then Grace Hartman got that last spot. So pretty good team, I think, on both sides. I think the men have a better shot at getting on the podium at the World Championships in Tallahassee in January. Yeah. And I'm going to be there to watch them. So,
really?
Yep. I run a race the next day on the same course.
Okay.
Yep.
Yeah.
So anyway, Rocky Hansen, though, I'll tell you what, Rocky Hansen, well, and Parker Wolf, but Rocky Hansen's still in college.
Yeah.
He's running with the big boys here. I'm really impressed with Rocky Hansen.
Yeah. No, that is pretty cool. I guess when you start to get my age, and by that I mean just like freshly out of college.
Yeah.
You see these people who you went to high school with, not with, but you were in high school with them, and now they're winning the U.S. Cross Country Championships. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Yeah. But you know, Rocky Hansen was coached by a guy I ran with in high school.
Was he really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that is cool.
During his high school career, he was. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Huh.
So pretty cool. Matter of fact, that same guy just coached the number 7 team in the country at Nike Cross Nationals.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. So anyway, Wayne looked really good at World Championships last year, so I'm hoping to see her up there. She has no kick, so she's got no chance of, you know, doing super well, but she can do pretty well. So, but I think the men have a good chance. Then at BU, Jane Hedegren ran 14:44 for a new NCAA record. I mean, it's her first track race as a freshman.
Yeah.
And she runs 14:44. It's just crazy how good this
wild.
She is. Wow. Have you paid any attention to her? What do you think about her?
She's not the one who broke 15 in high school.
Yes.
Was it really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I remember when that happened, and I was like, this is a different game.
It is.
I mean, that is insanity.
Yeah.
I mean, I when I was a freshman in college, I remember watching one of the Alabama girls run like 15:30 on an indoor track, and she was, you know, probably 26.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, this is crazy. You know, super senior Alabama girl runs 15:30. And then I remember seeing this girl run sub 15 in high school, and I was like, this is crazy.
I think she's got a shot at some big, big things. So one last story. So did you hear this story? I can't say this with a straight face.
Yeah, this isn't, I mean.
This lady is suing Nike because she says her Nike Alpha Flies caused a stress fracture on her foot when she ran in them in a race.
Yeah, yeah. Stay in school, kids. I mean,
Oh, my goodness. It's just crazy. I just don't know how people can live with themselves and do these kinds of things.
Yeah.
We all get injuries. And, there's no way to tell that if you'd have worn a different pair of shoes, you wouldn't have gotten that injury. You know, how are you going to prove that? I don't know what the – anyway, the world is so happy these days.
Is she sponsored by Nike?
No, gosh, no.
Okay.
No. This is just some what Let's Run calls a hobby job.
Oh, just okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a sad thing that everybody's a victim these days, and that's a sad thing. This kind of reminds me of this drives me crazy. I don't know about you, this drives me crazy. I can't handle somebody who does it once. Like in a decade, but somebody who does it regularly, who complains about the referees in a football game or a basketball game. It's always the referees. The referees are always the problem.
Yeah.
Oh, it drives me nuts.
Yeah. Except when they're getting paid by Georgia, you know what I mean? I'm just kidding. I am just kidding.
That's good stuff. All right. I remember back in, I guess it was in the 80s when McDonald's, some lady sued McDonald's because she spilled coffee on herself.
Yeah. I've heard about that one, I think.
Yeah, she won like $2 million or something.
Yeah.
That one and the other one I remember only because I'm a Georgia Tech guy. Jan Kemp was a lady who sued the University of Georgia. And I can't remember exactly. It was something about the way they treated football players different than our athletes different than they did other students. And she won a $2.4 million judgment.
Really?
Yeah. It was crazy.
That is wild.
Anyway, my hot take on this whole thing is that I think God commands us to settle our differences between each other one-on-one.
Yeah.
With no lawyer in between. And I think there are some times you obviously have to get a lawyer involved, but you should be trying to fix these things one-on-one first.
Yeah, I mean, hot coffee, I'd have to sue my Nana.
Yeah.
I mean, her coffee is boiling.
Our trivia question for this week. I think we've asked this question in the past, but it's a good one, and you brought it up earlier. The question is, what is VO2 max? What does that mean? You've probably heard it, but what does it mean? Send that to dean@upward.org. Be the first member to send me the correct answer, and you will win $20 off in the store. Our motivational thought of the week comes from Dina Castor, the silver medalist in a 2004 Olympic women's marathon. She said, "When you have enthusiasm and the passion, you end up figuring out how to excel." You know, I just had a discussion with somebody about this. We were talking about jobs, and that person was talking about how, you know, you eventually find the job that you can become passionate about. Mm-hmm. And I think that's backwards. I think that you be passionate about what you're doing today, and eventually that leads you to the job you can be most passionate about.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, to me, that's what Dina Castor is saying here. Have enthusiasm, have passion for what you're doing. If you're going out there and you're running or walking every day, have some enthusiasm about it, and it will make it better. It will absolutely be better. And again, back to this job thing, that's how you find your dream job. Yeah. Be passionate about what you have today, and it'll lead to that dream job later on. But so many people are just plodding through life, just getting through.
Yeah.
And that's not good. All right. Thanks, Lane, for filling. This is the 300th episode. Can you believe that?
Yeah,
and you that is a got lot. To be here for the number 300.
Yeah. So, thank you. It's my pleasure. Yeah.
We started this podcast 1 week. It's like 2 weeks before we said, "Hey, let's start a podcast," and we did, and we have not missed a week since.
Yeah,
six years ago. So
that is crazy. I didn't know it was 6 years ago. Yeah,
300 episodes, one a week.
Wow.
So yeah, pretty crazy. All right. If you haven't already, subscribe to this podcast. Subscribe to this channel if you're watching on YouTube. Do all the things. Rate our podcast and give us those 5-star reviews, because that helps us. And we want more people to hear about Jesus. And so let us do that. And until next week, may God bless every step of every run and or walk. Go out there and shine your light.
Good job, Dean.
For more information about Upward Running, visit upwardrunning.com. If you have questions about your salvation, click on the Peace with God tab. There is nothing more important. Thanks for joining us today.